Yeah, welcome everybody. As you see, Professor Honegger made his promise true and he handed this lecture over to me. And I have a short plan here. First of all, this is the URL where you can download the videos. And they are hosted by the Fachschaft Informatik, not by the Rechenzentrum. So it's not the same URL where you can download the previous lecture recordings, but it's a different one. And as you can see today, it's me who is presenting the lecture. Next Monday, Marco Bögel. The next three appointments, Professor Honegger has some urgent schedules. But next week, Marco Bögel will fill in. Then the Thursday next week, we will call off. So there won't be a lecture on Thursday. So you get to sleep a little bit longer on that day. And the Monday after that, Professor Honegger will return and he will hopefully do all of the lectures for the remaining lecture term. Okay, now I need a bit of help. So far I know you have been talking about singular value decomposition. How much did he actually tell you? Maybe you can help me and we can also think about what we heard in the last lecture. Who remembers?
The last slide was slide 10.
Last slide was slide 10. Sounds reasonable. Which would be this one, which is the formal definition of SVD. And I figure he told you something about what a matrix does to a unit ball. How it deforms it? Yes, no? Yes, yes, that's good. And did he talk about what the decomposition does? No. No. Maybe we just talk about it again. Who has heard about this in IMIP already? Ah, that's not too many. Okay, good. Good, then let's talk about that. Who was the candidate of the day in the last lecture?
There is no candidate of the day.
So we're all candidates. You're all candidates of the day. Okay. I would have had only one question for the candidate of the day. Do you know what the candidate of the week is? Okay, good. Let's talk a bit here about SVD. I put this up for some, so I'll start writing here, okay? So let's summarize what you've seen last time. So you've seen that if you think of the vectors that all have length 1, let's say here is 1 and here is 1, and let's see if I can draw this. Ah, it's getting better with every attempt I try. So this is the unit ball, and this is the set of vectors that all have length 1. Yeah? And you've seen that if you apply some kind of matrix A, so let's say you apply a 2x2 matrix A, and then this matrix has a certain effect on your vectors. And it will probably do something like this with your vectors. So it will somehow deform them. And you can think of a matrix as some operation that deforms your unit vectors. Okay? And now you've seen that you can decompose any matrix into three matrices. Why would that be useful? Yes? Inversion gets easy, for example. Exactly. Did he talk about inversion, how to do that? Did you already hear that last time? Kind of. I see nodding. Yeah, so I'm still going to repeat it. So please interrupt me. If I'm telling stuff that you've already heard, interrupt me. So you can hear it a second time if you look at the video recording. You can hear it a couple of times if you look at the video recordings of the past anyway. Okay, good. So you can now decompose it into three matrices. And the nice thing here is that sigma is only a diagonal matrix. And the other two matrices, they are orthonormal matrices. So in principle, you can think of these two matrices as rotation matrices. And now you can decompose basically this thing here into three steps. So what you do is you get your unit ball, and then you apply your first matrix to it. And this is the matrix U. And what U will do is it's a rotation matrix. So U will do nothing else but rotate your set of points. If you rotate your unit ball, and it doesn't do any scaling. If you rotate your unit ball, there's not much to see, because your unit ball, after a rotation, it will still look like this. So this part is interesting if you have something else than a unit ball. Then the next matrix, this is a diagonal matrix with some entries on only on the diagonal. And what this will do is it will perform a kind of scaling. So you can think of, if you apply your matrix sigma here, you can interpret it as some kind of scaling that you perform to your unit ball, and the scaling is along to your axis. Yeah? So what it will do is it will probably generate you something like this. Okay? So it will apply as, so here we have some downscaling on the y-axis and some upscaling on the x-axis. And then I apply V transpose, and V transpose will do the following thing. It will rotate your set of points back, and then you have the outcome of your matrix A. So this is what V transpose does. And if you now compare this to what you've seen up here, you see that the multiplication of the three matrices gives you exactly the same deformation that you would obtain if you had applied A. Yeah? So you can also think of a matrix decomposition in a geometric way, which is kind of useful. Yeah? So generally, it's very useful to think about different problems or different notations that you already know and try to interpret them in a different way. This often gives you an improved feeling how the method actually works. And so geometrically speaking, this is always very nice because it's easy to visualize. Yeah? So you can think about matrix multiplication suddenly in a geometric way, and you can think about how it affects different vectors. Immediately, if you look at this, we can immediately think about what happens if one of the diagonal values in sigma is zero, right? What will happen? So they are ordered, by the way. They are ordered. The largest value comes first, and then the second largest. So the if you want to have one zero element, it must be sigma 2, right? So what will happen if I put a zero in sigma 2? Can you think about that? This will only affect the scaling step, right? Yes? Yeah, yeah, exactly. We get a rank deficient matrix, of course. And you can then also see why it's rank deficient, because your sigma step will suddenly result in something which looks like this. Yeah? So you get rid of the y dimension in this case. And then if you apply your rotation, you will get something that looks like this. Yeah? Right? So this is, now you can immediately understand why what the rank deficiency does. The rank deficiency cancels out one dimension. Yeah? And if you have a very low singular value, you will end up with something that looks like this. Or let's stay in this coordinate frame. If you have a very low singular value, you will end something which looks like this. So this is a very narrow ellipse. And you can imagine if you try to invert this. So if you try to invert this transformation, you're trying to go back. Yeah? You're trying to go into exactly the opposite direction. And while it's you can find transforms that convert your circle into a line, you would have to divide by zero at this place, right? So you don't know the original scaling along that axis. So this is why you can't invert it. But what you can do is you can do an approximate scaling, but you won't get rid of the rank deficiency. Let me just draw this very narrow ellipse. So this is when you have a very small sigma. You get something very narrow. And now you can also imagine if you have a very small sigma here, in the inversion, you would have to divide by something which is very small, and this makes the inversion very unstable. Because if you have some numerical instability there, you will have a broad range. So a very small change along this axis will then have, so you divide by a very small number, so we are actually multiplying by a huge number. And this means that you then have a huge effect along this axis. So let's say you have measurement noise in this direction, then the noise will be amplified by the inversion. Yeah? So this is one of the things that you can immediately see if you try to invert this transform. So it's no problem to invert the two rotations, but it's a problem to invert the sigma. And what we'll also see on the following slides is that if you try to estimate, so you can, if you have a matrix that has rank deficiency, you can't invert it, right? But what you can do is you can estimate pseudo-inverse, which is the best thing that you can do. Let's say in a term, in a least square sense, it's the best thing you can do. And what do you do is you define a pseudo-inverse, which is a dagger. And a dagger is nothing else than the inverse. So we're trying to invert this matrix. And you see this is U times sigma times V transpose. And the inverse of a rotation matrix is, of course, its transpose. And you have to invert the sequence. So what you will get is V. Then we need to figure out some way of inverting sigma. And you get U transpose. So the sequence is inverted. You have to find an inversion for sigma, and your matrices are transposed because a rotation matrix is inverted by its transpose. Okay? Then you get this. And how do we invert the sigma here? Well, if you remember, sigma is a diagonal matrix. Do you know the inverse for a diagonal matrix? Yes? I can't hear you. Speak up.
It's the matrix itself.
It would be if it were the identity matrix. So if you have ones on the diagonal, it's the matrix itself. Yes?
You have to divide every one by every singular value.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So sigma has this form. So the inverse, or let's say, let's say there's a zero here, yeah? So generally, the inverse of a diagonal matrix is just 1 divided over the original value. And then you get 1 over sigma 2, and so on. And now this is the part where the pseudo comes in. We just replace values. Because at this point, we would have to divide by 0, right? And division by 0 is something we will learn in the following of the lecture. But we won't divide by zero right now. So what we will do is we will just replace it by a zero. Okay? And this is very nice because then you can see if I multiply this guy with this guy, you will see they cancel out. But we won't get we won't get identity because we have the zero elements here, and they will just cancel out. So if you multiply those two with each other, you should get a matrix that has ones on everywhere where you have a valid singular value, where you have a non-zero singular value. And you'll get zeros at the place where you have singular values, where you don't have a valid singular value. Sorry. OK? So matrix inversion, very nice with SVD. And you can formally write it down. And this inversion scheme is actually identical to computation of the Moore-Penrose pseudo-inverse. But this is all stuff you know, so we don't repeat it here. Yeah? Okay. Well, we still have a couple of slides that we should go through. And this is like the, so this is some stuff, but it's easy to follow. And we have some more definitions here. But let's say you go to the oral exam, I'd say that you should at least know these things. And you should probably also know those properties. They are quite important. And did Professor Honegger, did he tell you about the rumor in the oral exam?
Yes.
Yes, you heard about the rumor. So if you hear a very strange question and you're not absolutely sure what the examiner is actually getting to, it's quite likely that you just have to answer SVD. Yeah? How do we solve this problem? SVD. It's a quite likely correct answer. But not for all problems in this class. But for many. Good, let's have a look at some of these properties. So we already figured out that we can compute the rank of a matrix. This is just counting all the non-zero elements of sigma. This will give us the rank. And we have a rank deficiency if we have singular values that are zero. Then we can compute the numerical epsilon rank of a matrix. So this is something which is quite important if you really work this in this in a real problem, because sometimes you have very low non-zero singular values. Let's say it's 10 to the power of minus 5. If you have a singular value that's 10 to the power of minus 5, then it's very close to zero. And in fact, this very low number will cause you quite a bit of trouble in your later computations. So in this case, you can define that if the singular value is below a certain threshold epsilon, you just set it to zero. Yeah? And then you clearly know that you have a rank deficient matrix. So you can compute the numerical epsilon rank, and then you replace zero by some small value, let's say 10 to the power of minus 3. Yeah? This could be one choice for epsilon, but of course your epsilon is problem dependent. Then you can compute your original matrix. Here we have a summation formula. And the summation formula, so you didn't go through the properties of SVD yet, right? Why is it sufficient to, so this has the vectors of U and V transpose. Multiplied with each other, and then multiplied with the respective singular value. Why is it sufficient to sum only from 1 to r? Well, r is our rank. So, yes?
Because above we stated that r is the number of non-singular singular
yes.
values, and the vectors which are multiplied and multiplied by
yes, exactly. So you can just skip those in the computation of A, right? And the other nice thing of this is if you have two vectors and you compute the outer product of two vectors, you get a matrix. What's the rank of this matrix? If you take two vectors and multiply them with each other, what is the rank, the maximum rank that it can have? One, yes, exactly, because all the columns of the matrix are linear dependent from each other. Yeah? So because every column in that matrix is a scaled instance of the first column. Yeah? If you think of V transpose as a set of weights, then what you get in the columns of the matrix is just scaled versions of U. So the maximum rank that this matrix can have is 1. Keep that in mind. If you ever see something where you just have two vectors multiplied with each other and it gives a matrix, this matrix must have rank 1. And the nice thing is now you have here orthonormal basis vectors, and you sum up over these matrices. You're basically summing up independent sets of vectors, because all the entries of U must be orthogonal to each other, right? So this means that the columns of the different matrices that you are adding up, they are not linear dependent. And in this case, when you do the summation, you end up with a matrix that has exactly rank R, because you're summing up one rank matrices of rank one, and they give you exactly your original matrix again. Yeah. Okay. So this is, I know everybody here in this room knows this already, but it's a nice way of thinking about matrices and properties of matrices, because if you see a vector multiplication or a matrix vector multiplication, there's often also a geometric interpretation or some interpretation of the product that actually can be explained in a couple of words, and then you can think about the whole thing in the big picture. Not always, but in many cases you can think about these things in simple summations, and then you get interpretations that are quite nice. Well, then the Frobenius norm of the matrix can be written as the sum over the square of the singular values and then the square root. And then you have some nice properties that if you have A multiplied with V, I, you get sigma and UI, and you can find a similar term if you multiply A with a vector from UI. And then you can also interpret the column vectors of U as the eigenvectors of A times A transpose, and you can interpret the column vectors of V as the eigenvectors of A transpose A. Okay, very useful properties. Then we can also think about the kernel and the null space. It's very nice that your column vectors of V, they are spanning the kernel, and the range of the matrix, they are spanned by the column vectors of U. Yeah, so you can also say the image, yeah, the range of the matrix or the image of the matrix is spanned by U, and the kernel is spanned by V. You can also think about it in this way if you have this rank, so you need some rank deficient problem, yeah, in order to think about this. And you can then see that if you try to invert your problem, you will see that your image direction is this direction, which is the direction that all your points are projected on, and your null space is the direction that is perpendicular to it. Yeah? Good. Then for the two norm of the matrix, we get that you can rewrite it as the maximum over the x with length equals to 1. And this is just the square of sigma 1. And if A is regular, then we even have that the 2 norm of the inverse is 1 over the smallest singular value, smallest non-zero singular value. Good. Here we have an example. And you can actually reproduce this example very easily. You just take this matrix A, you type it into MATLAB, and you can play with it. So this is actually how we built this example. So you just take matrix A, type it to MATLAB, and how do you get the SVD in MATLAB? SVD. Yes, you type SVD of matrix, and then you get 3 matrices. And this is what we did here. So this is the matrix. And here you can see this matrix is almost rank deficient. So if you define your epsilon rank as 10 to the power of minus 3, this is a rank deficient matrix. If you define it in a different way, it's not rank deficient, but it has a very slow singular, very low singular value. And here you get your matrices U and V. Okay. You can actually try this. You can then multiply U sigma and V transpose, and you will end up with the same matrix. And now you can also do stuff like computation of the pseudo inverse, like we said here. So you can manipulate the matrix and see what gets out of it. And then you can multiply the pseudo inverse with the original matrix and see the effect of this multiplication. And you will, and you can observe exactly what I've just shown you here on the board. Good. So if you select 10 to the power of minus 3, obviously we get a rank deficiency. And you can then get the kernel. So the null space is spanned by the single vector. And you will see it's the last column vector of V transpose. And you can have the range, which is a 2D range, because you have two non-singular values. And this is spanned by the two first vectors of U. We can now also think about when is a matrix ill-conditioned. And ill-conditioned is a problem that often arises in practical applications, that you suddenly have something that is ill-conditioned. And people often write it's ill-conditioned. And sometimes they never show whether it's really ill-conditioned. But if you want to show that something is ill-conditioned, you can compute the condition number. And the condition number is the norm of the matrix multiplied with the inverse of the matrix, with the norm of the matrix. And then you get the condition number kappa. And the condition number kappa will be infinity, or if it's singular. So if you have a rank deficiency, you will get plus infinity on your condition number. Well, this is, if you consider what we just said, you can think of the 2 norm as the largest singular value to the power of 2 multiplied 1 over the smallest singular value. And if this is 0, 1 over 0 will go towards infinity. And then you have something multiplied with something which goes towards infinity. And you can see that then the condition number would go towards infinity. You will have well-conditioned problem if your condition number is in the ballpark of 1, which means that all of your singular values are about in the same range. Well, so let's say you have a rotation matrix. In this case, you will get a very good condition problem. Okay, so a matrix with a condition number 1 is called well-conditioned, and if it's significantly greater than 1, let's say 1,000, then you have a ill-conditioned problem. And this 1,000 is pretty nice because it more or less reflects our epsilon rank. Okay. This condition number is telling you something about the properties of the matrix, and this boils down to what I said earlier. If you have a very low change in your output space, it will imply a high change in your input space. So if you have, so you're trying to invert this guy, so if you have a small change in B, you will have a large change in X. And just because you have a huge scaling in the inversion process here. You can compute, for any matrix, you can compute the exact condition number with SVD, but if you get large matrices, then you end up with something that is computationally quite expensive. So there's other methods to computing the numerical rank that are faster. Okay, let's consider the previous example. And we have singular values 71, 21, and 6, 0.0006. Then you get a condition number of something which is in the range of 100,000. So this is an ill-conditioned problem. And now what you can do if you go home or if you go to the SIP pool, you can try computing this, and then you can show that if you change B in 0.1%, so a change of 0.1% in B will actually give you a change in X, which is in the order of 240%. So this is an error that is really amplified during your inversion process. So be careful. If you have rank deficient problems, you will get huge changes in the output space. Okay, and now we have some kind of a couple of practical problems. One problem here is, so let us consider the following problem that appears in many image processing computer vision problems. We computed a matrix A out of sensor data like an image. By theory, the matrix A must have the singular values sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma up to sigma p, where p is the minimum of the dimensions m and n. So A is an m times n matrix, and p is the minimum of m times n. In practice, A does not fulfill this constraint. What is the matrix A prime that is closest to A according to the Frobenius norm and has the required singular values? So if you now do this and you do the SVD, then you can compute the A prime using the diagonals up to P. Okay, so you let us rephrase the problem. You get some data and you want to determine, you want to estimate a matrix from the data. Yeah? Now you get the data and your data has noise. And because of the noise, your estimate will give you a matrix that has a larger rank, has more singular values than the ones that you actually require. Yeah? So you require p singular values, but you get more than p singular values. Okay? And the thing is, how can we actually get this matrix down to p singular values? Well, you can multiply this. You can just use the estimate of your sigma, and then just cancel out the singular values that are larger than p. And this is now, let's say this is a bit suboptimal, that p will actually, so let's say it's not, p is smaller than minimum n to n. Let's say p is 4, yeah? And you have a matrix, and you want to enforce that it has rank 4. Yeah. So what you do is you compute the SVD of your matrix, and then you keep the 4 largest singular values, and you set everything else to 0. And then you multiply u times the diagonal matrix up to the rank that you actually have, that you actually desire, and then we transpose, and you get a matrix that has exactly the rank that you require. So you suppress those ranks that have very small singular values. Let's say we want to do that in the previous problem, and we want to enforce rank 2. We do the SVD, and then we take the singular value that was 0.0006, and we set it to 0. And then we multiply u, sigma, and we transpose, and we get a matrix that has exactly rank 2. Yeah? So we don't need the numerical rank anymore, but it has exactly rank 2. And what it does is it basically narrows down the small axis to a single line here. Yeah? This is what it does. And this way you can enforce a certain rank criterion on your matrix. Okay, so let's pick the original example. And here we set the last singular value to 0. So what we do is, in this case, we even know that the two singular values, the first singular value 1 and 2, should be the same. So sometimes you can show by theory in some computer vision problems, for example, or in factorization. This is something which you will hear in IMIP in the second part of the lecture. Some of you have already heard this. Here you know by theory that the two singular values should be the same. So what do we do is we take the two singular values, just add them and divide by 2. And we do the same for the second singular value. We just add them and divide by 2. Now we have created a matrix that has the same singular value for singular value 1 and singular value 2, and we set the last value to 0. Yeah? And in this case, we get a matrix that has rank 2. So this is a bit of sloppy. I mean, you would need the last entry in this diagonal matrix if you really want to do the multiplication. Or you have to select subsets of U and V in order to construct this. Yeah? Yes?
Is this averaging just for the first two elements or for the entire rank? I mean, this averaging for the...
Yes.
Is this only for the first two values or for...
What happens if you add something like 0 to it? It will be 0. Well, you would be dividing by 3. So you would change the singular value. Now, in this case, this is taken... Oh, so the 0 is even in there. Sorry, I missed it. In this case, we know by theory that the two singular values should be the same. And if you divide by 2 or 3, this is more or less a heuristic. Yeah? So you could also divide by 3 and add something that is 0, and you would still get some singular values that are identical. In fact, this problem comes from computer vision, and here you are estimating something which is identical up to scaling. And in this case, it doesn't matter if you divide by 2 or 3, because the solution will be only correct up to scaling. So what you get is something multiplied by a non-zero constant, and it will be the same solution. We will talk in this class later about projective geometry and homogeneous coordinates. And in this case, you will see that you get identities that are identical up to scaling. Yeah? And in this case, it wouldn't matter. So this is an applied problem. This is where how you can use this SVD in practice. Okay? Good. So this is how we enforce rank criteria. Then optimization problem 2. In fact, if I remember, this is not this is not factorization, but this is from estimation of the essential matrix. Sorry about that. Okay, optimization problem 2. We want to minimize a function, and we know that we want to select the minimal x, and it should be minimal with respect to the matrix A. So x transpose times A times x should be minimal subject to that the length of x is equal to 1. Or if you put this to an extreme case, you could say that A times x equals 0. So sometimes you end up with linear equations, and your linear equation is not A times x equals B, but B is a 0 vector. So it's a vector only containing zeros. And now you want to compute the x that is actually minimizing this problem, and you can do that by computing the null space. So this is exactly a null space problem. So if we hadn't this constraint that the length of x equals to 1, there would be a very simple solution for this guy, right? So if I set x to 0, this equation is fulfilled. But a vector of only zeros doesn't have the length of 1. So we must look for a different solution that minimizes this problem. And you can very easily construct this because this is a null space problem. You're just interested in the null space of your matrix. And you can do that by using the rightmost column of V. Yeah? So here we want to estimate a matrix A such that the following vectors estimate matrix A such that for the following vectors the optimization problems get solved. Okay, here we have a set of vectors B, 4 vectors, and now we want to select a matrix A that is minimal subject to the Frobenius norm equals to 1. Then we can actually rewrite this problem, and this is something what we do all the time in this lecture, and this is something you have to get used to, and this is a very interesting approach to solve problems. But this is a pretty hard problem, right? So B transpose and then the matrix A and BI. And then you have even a rank criterion, you have a criterion on the Frobenius norm. So this is hard to solve, but what we do instead is we rewrite the problem. And we rewrite the problem into a measurement matrix. And this measurement matrix now is set up such that it fulfills exactly the previous optimization problem. And instead of minimum, we just say it needs to be zero, because the sum would be minimal if we added it up. So this is a sum of squares, yeah? This is a sum of squares, and the sum of squares will be zero if all the different parts of the sum are zero. If it's non-zero and it's squared, it will be higher than zero. Even if it were negative, it would be higher. So if I want this to be minimal, the absolute minimum would be zero, and now what I do is I take this part here and just check that I set it to zero. Yeah? And now I can rewrite this, and I end up with this kind of matrix notation. And now I design a matrix M that contains all the measured data. So the measured data are all the Bs. Yeah? So we have those four vectors B, and those four vectors B must go into the measurement matrix. And if you think of the previous problem, this is square in B, yeah? So B gets squared in this equation. But your coefficients of A, they appear linear in here. So if you consider the case where everything is zero, then you can actually construct a matrix multiplication that has the elements of A as a vector, and you rewrite your matrix into this vector notation, and then you can show that this equals to this, so these are your components of A, and this equation is linear in the components of A, which allows you to rewrite it into BI square and so on. So this has square and linear components of B, and this has only linear components of A, which means this is a linear problem, and if we have a linear problem, we can solve it with SVD. Yeah. So I can now rewrite it in here, and now my I is indexing the number of the vector. So this was 1 to 4 in the previous case. And I have now four equations that that all need to be zero. And then if I have four equations, I can just put it into a system of linear equations. And you see that we can now determine this entire matrix M. Yes?
I have a question on the previous slide.
Yes. Yeah, so this is essentially, yeah, this is the product that comes out of here. Yeah, so BI1 times BI1, which is the other index here, will go into this vector, and it needs to be zero. So, yeah, this is something you will start developing an eye for during this course. It's very nice that if you have linear problems, then you can take elements of the matrix, and although you're looking for a matrix, you can rewrite the elements of the matrix into a vector, and then you can solve for this vector just with linear systems of equations. And this is exactly what we're doing here. So now my measurement matrix has B squares and normal Bs, and if you consider the previous problem, you can, you see now that we have four rows in B, in M. And those four rows, they are exactly the four equations that need, so the four parts of the summation that need to go to zero. And then we can actually do the math and put in the values, and you end up with the matrix on the right. And if you now take this matrix on the right, you compute the pseudo-inverse. You're not computing the pseudo-inverse because we have a null space problem. But you are trying to find the null space of M. And the null space will be the right, so you do SVD of M, and using SVD, you get your three matrices, U, sigma, and V transpose. And in U, V transpose, So actually in V, you take the last column, and this will give you the null space. And if you do that, you will see that you get you can construct from the null space of M this matrix A, and you get this matrix. And well, you can now put it into your previous summation and check it, and check whether it fulfills the previous optimization problem. One thing that we can see is that this solution here fulfills the Frobenius norm, and fulfills the constraint that the Frobenius norm needs to be 1, right? Because you take all the elements of the matrix, you square them, and then you take the square root, and we have the root of 2 in 2 elements of this matrix. The other 2 are 0. So this has a Frobenius norm of 1. Good. Then the third optimization problem. We compute a matrix, and now this boils down to exactly what we had earlier. We have another rank criterion, and we just pick the number of values, the singular values that we need to compute this rank. So this is very similar to the previous problem. Okay. Then we can compute. Okay, so let's do a rank 1 enforcement on an image, and we can do that by taking this image, and now we just interpret the entire image here as a matrix, and you compute the SVD of this image, and then you just take the rank 1 approximation. Yeah. So you set all the other singular values to 0, and you compute this rank 1 approximation, and you can visualize it again as image, and this is your rank 1 approximation of the image, which is quite nice because in this rank 1 visualization, you can see that you have essentially the collimator here. Does everybody understand what we see on this image? So this is an X-ray image, and this is fluoroscopy. And what they did is they have a collimator blade entering here and here. So this is a piece of lead that you put into the X-ray beam in order to minimize the radiation for the patient. Yeah? So you put those two blades into your X-ray beam, and then you're only irradiating this part here. So somebody here is interested in the spine, and they only irradiate the spine and the area where they want to get at. And they use collimation to reduce the dose. And sometimes you're interested in detecting those collimator blades because only in between you have the actual part of the image where you have actually measured data. And the other parts of the image you don't get. So imagine. Okay. So this is actually something we'll talk about slightly later in the class. If you put something into the beam, and you only irradiate your primary target, but you still measure some stuff here and here, do you know why we still get some signal here and here? Although we had collimator blades in the beam, and actually there shouldn't be any radiation. Scatter. Yes. So the patient itself generates scattered radiation, so there are scattering events, and because of the scatter, you get some radiation here. So you still measure something, and you can see that what you measure here is very smooth, and this is because scatter has a very low frequency in terms of your image. And using our rank 1 approximation, we can get a quite good estimate of the position of the collimator blades in our image. Optimization problem 4. This is now the Moore-Penrose pseudo inverse, and this is something we already talked about here. Yeah, this is that we can get the pseudo inverse. This is how it's published by Moore and Penrose. So it's A transpose. So if you compute A transpose times A, you end up with a matrix that you can actually invert. and then you multiply it with A transpose, and in this case you get the pseudo inverse. But you can also compute it with SVD by using this trick with the singular values. And here's the example how to construct sigma dagger. And you can use this, for example, to solve a regression problem. So what you want to do if you want to have a regression problem, does everybody know what a regression line is? Yes, of course. Okay, so you have a set of points and you want to fit a line such that it optimally fits to the set of points. And with optimally fitting, I mean that the least square distance is minimal. So the squared distance to the line should be minimal, and you can construct this with pseudo inverse. And how do we do that? Well, you have your y's and your x's. So you're measuring x and y, and you're interested in m and t. So you have a set of linear equations, and you have way more equations than unknowns. And then this is your measurement matrix, and these are your observations. So these are your observations for x. For t, we just put ones, because if you take this times here, you just want to have the weight of one for t. So t gets only once. This is the value for x, and this is the value for y. And then we can put it into a vector and into a matrix. And, well, you compute the Moore-Penrose pseudo-inverse for your matrix on the left and multiply it to the vector on the right. And if you do that, you see that you get exactly a vector with two values, and these are your estimates of MMT. So regression. Fitting a regression line, no problem. We can do that with SVD in no time. Yeah? And you will learn that there's many more regression or fitting problems that you can solve in a very similar way. So what you need to do is you have to massage the problem such that you get a solution that is linear in your coefficients. And when you have some set of equations that's linear in the unknowns, you can rearrange it as a huge matrix multiplication problem or as a kind of matrix multiplication problem. You compute the inverse of your measurement matrix, multiply it on the other side, and there you go. You have the solution. Okay. Just some comments. We are not discussing here how SVD actually is implemented. SVD is available in many toolboxes. You have it in MATLAB. You have it in most libraries that work with image processing problems or any signal processing libraries usually contain an SVD implementation. So we don't have to care how it's actually implemented, but we know what it gives us, and we know how to use what we get from this implementation. Nice things are that it can be computed for any matrix. It is numerically very robust, and it has a complexity of m squared n plus 8 times m times n squared plus 9 times n to the power of 3. So in most practical applications, we have significantly more rows than columns. So we have some m that is really much higher than n. And if your n is quite small, you have a complexity of about m to the power of 2. Yeah? In O notation, it would be, if n is small, significantly smaller, then you can say it has a quadratic complexity. Take-home messages. SVD is the tool for linear equations. Remember the rumor? Somebody might be getting to that this problem is just linear, and if it's linear, you can solve it with SVD. Be aware, if you have very large problems that we will see later in this class, like the reconstruction problems, they are still linear, but they are not really suited for SVD, but we will get to this point, and I'll put in a note that you should not try to solve them with SVD unless you have really small reconstruction problems, for example. So you have SVD in all standard libraries, And for us, it's always our first choice. If we want to solve a linear problem, we will first try SVD. And if SVD really fails, in this case, we can look for something else. But SVD will usually do a very good job. And SVD is most probably the right answer to any question in the oral exam. It's maybe a bit exaggerated. Okay, good. Further readings. You can read the original by Jean Gollop. Then you can see a very detailed and easy to follow to SVD in Carlo Tomasi's class notes. I have the link in here. And yeah, there's also three rebooks that you can have a look at, which are all very interesting. And there's even an Amazon link in here that you can download them. And what's also very nice is to have a look at the numerical implementation. And you have, does everybody here know numerical recipes? Yes, I see one person nodding. So numerical recipes is a very good website. It's actually books and websites. And they have several instructions, so they have instructions how to implement actually such numerical methods very robustly. And they even have examples that you can download, and you can download the book and have the descriptions to several numerical methods, and they also deal with SVD, so you can have a look at this one. Okay, so far about SVD. Some questions about it? Or no questions so far? Give it a try. Open MATLAB, open or some other software development tool, and just give it a try and experiment with it. Try those examples that we have on the slides. This is really, really useful. And try to think about it and play with different images and SVD. This is really useful to get a good feeling how the method actually works. Okay, good. Then we talked about SVD, which means we can go to the next chapter, which would be pre-processing. Yeah, for some reason I left my name here in the slides, and it turns out to be useful. Okay, no more questions about SVD. Then we would go to the next chapter, which would be pre-processing. Everybody okay with that? Nobody wants to stop. If you want to stop now and say this is a boring class, you can also leave. Or you can watch the video later. Okay, let's continue with pre-processing. So let's have a definition of pre-processing. What is actually pre-processing? Pre-processing is everything that happens from the acquisition device until the image is displayed on the monitor. And now pre-processing is part of your acquisition modality. So pre-processing is any kind of transformation that you apply on the measured image before you show it on a monitor in the lab, for example. Or if you think of an extended pre-processing, the entire CT reconstruction process, where you are reconstructing an image, we would consider this as a kind of pre-processing, because in the end you display the image. This is the reconstructed slice. But everything that happens in between, from the measurement, so you take line integral data and reconstruct the slice, everything before we show the slice would be considered as pre-processing in this definition. And also, you do pre-processing on your image data. So if you don't think about reconstruction, but just 2D imaging, you can apply any transform of your image data before you actually show it on the image. And it can be used to get rid of certain problems that you have in your acquisition process. So let's say you have a team of engineers, and of X-ray specialists, and they are building an X-ray measurement device. So they have the X-ray source, they have some kind of detector, and they keep building this. And they, in order to develop the entire system, it takes them, it takes 2 years. Took them 2 years to develop an X-ray system, and then they do the first measurements, they did all the simulations, they did all the math, how to actually align the system, how to actually build the system, and in the end they build a system. And then they get the first measurement. And what turns out is that they had some optimistic, on the first hand, they thought some things would work better, so they had some optimism when they constructed the device, but in the end it showed that they still have some problems in the image. And they get artifacts, and the other thing that they get for sure is noise. And as you might know, in X-ray imaging, the image noise is inversely proportional to the dose, so it means the more dose you apply, the less noise you have. You probably want to cut down on dose because it's not that good for the patient, so you may end up with quite some noise in your image. And what you do then is you have some image, and then you might have artifacts in there, you have problems in there, but before you show it on the screen, you apply pre-processing. So you never show this image to anybody, but you apply your pre-processing, and then you show the image to somebody. And the nice thing is, because you never showed the intermediate image to anybody, people will never figure out what you did in this pre-processing, because this is something that you never showed to somebody. And so this is one thing. So you never tell people what you do in your pre-processing. By many companies, this is kept as this is a well-kept secret. So they won't tell anybody what they do in the pre-processing, and they consider it as a kind of, it's a company secret what they do in pre-processing, and they do some tricks, and they never show you that they may had some problem when they constructed the system. So because what happened is they had 2 years, some X-ray engineers working on the system, they had the first measurement, and they came up with artifacts, and then they hired their image processing specialist, and he fired up MATLAB, played around with the image for, let's say, half a day, and then he has a much nicer image. And what goes into the product is, of course, the much nicer image. But you never tell your boss that it took you half a day to create the nice image. Instead, you tell your boss it took you 1 month to create the nice image. And then you have about 1 month of time to do actually all the things that are on the list of your boss. So this is also a well-kept secret amongst engineers. You never tell your boss how long it actually takes, but you always do a very safe time computation when you're estimating your efforts. Yeah? Don't tell your boss you did it in half a day. Because if you do that once, next time he comes, he will also think it's the same kind of problem, it takes half a day, and it actually implies a lot of numerical derivations. But he talked to marketing, and marketing considered it's the same kind of problem, so it should be done in half a day as well. Yeah, always be sure that you have some leeway, so that you have enough time to actually implement the stuff. Okay, good. So let's see, and all of this pre-processing, this is what we did in half a day in order to figure out how to get the good image, and this is then kept as a company secret. In contrast to pre-processing is post-processing. Post-processing are steps that you do on an image after you've shown it to the user. And if you do that, it's evil. Pre-processing is good because you never tell anybody what you actually did. Post-processing is evil. It may involve the same image transforms, but post-processing is evil because you showed this image already to somebody. And then the somebody may be a radiologist, and he is used to the kind of images that he already has seen. So he is used to his image noise. When he sets his machine to the setting and he creates this image, he will get exactly this kind of image. And if you then remove the noise, he will tell you, you did something evil to my image. It doesn't show the noise anymore. This is why this image must be wrong. I do not trust this image. And this is actually what happened when they wanted to reduce noise, and they showed that they could actually reduce the noise in CT imaging, and you have low-dose protocols that have very similar image quality to what they are actually used in higher doses, and they did measurements, see those, so image noise is the same as in the high-dose protocol, but the radiologist was used to his low-dose protocol, and he could see the image noise. And then they said, no, I don't like this image. I want my image back with the noise that I'm really related to. So I know this image, and I know this noise, and I can interpret the noise pattern. So what he was basically telling them is that actually noise is also a very good measure of uncertainty. So if you have a lot of noise in the image, it may also be quite good because it can also tell you that you're not too sure what is shown in this image. And of course, there's really specialists out there that really can interpret noise patterns and use that for their diagnosis. This having said, so radiologists work with those images every day, and they are very well used to the kind of image that you present and the imaging mechanism. If you start fiddling around with an image and make it better, but you can measure actually that you have a reduced noise, you have improved contrast and what so on, but the radiologist will have a hard time getting used to these new kind of images. And in some cases, you can actually see that even though you improve the image, the prediction performance is maybe impaired just because the radiologist is not used to this kind of imaging modality or to this kind of post-processing that they applied. Having said all this, you can imagine that it's very, very difficult to bring a new imaging technology into your device. So let's say you are switching from image intensifiers, which was a well-known technology in fluoroscopy, and they switched to flat panel. It took them a long time to actually convince everybody that this technology is really better. And it just because image characteristics were different, noise was different, and some of the interventionalists were claiming they can see stuff better on the fluoroscopy device than on the flat panel detector. And you could show by measurement that the claims that they actually made were not that accurate. But they were used to it, and they could see very subtle details within the noise which are really difficult to measure. So generally, image quality, as soon as you start having nonlinear processes in the formation of your image, it's very difficult to measure image quality and actually to show who is right. So there's a lot of discussions about images and image quality. And if you buy a fluoroscopy system now, you will see that you get an image quality expert who comes to your lab. So the interventionalist is buying a system, and then they get one day with an image quality expert. And what they do is they adjust the pre-processing. So they're telling the interventionalist that they're really adjusting the device, but what's actually happening is that they do a fine tuning of the pre-processing, and then they show them different pictures, and he gets to select which picture he likes best, and by that they determine for a different procedure different parameter sets for the pre-processing. So he has this, then he's presented like a matrix of images, which is just a set of two parameters and all different combinations shown, and he gets to select the image that he likes best. And in different hospitals, they have different settings for the pre-processing adapted to the primary user of the system. And these differences vary considerably between different users. So some users want more noise because they like a crisp and sharp image. Other users want some more smoothing, and they really adopt this pre-processing to a specific user nowadays. But it's all part of the imaging process. This is why it's pre-processing. If you do it afterwards, it's post-processing, and post-processing is evil because somebody will ask you, what did you do to my image? I'm used to it in a different way. Yeah, there's even a product out there by one of the big companies that is doing a blend. So what they do is they reconstruct two images, one with the traditional method that has a lot of noise, and the other image is using a different reconstruction method that has a lot of noise suppression. And then the user gets to select the amount of noise reduction that he likes best. So you can blend in basically comfort noise just for the user that he feels more comfortable with this image. And you can go from a 100% previous method to 0%, which means completely denoised by the new method. And then there's even clinical studies out there that argue which of these settings is the best for a certain kind of diagnosis. So then, and what they often come up with is 50% is the best setting. If you do a linear blend between the two images, this is the best setting for whatever kind of procedure. Okay, long story about pre-processing, but I think this is important for you to know. Let's say you accept the job at industry, you will immediately understand why they are not very eager to share any details about their pre-processing and why everybody tries to omit post-processing. Good. This is what I already said, noise reduction, contrast enhancement, blah, blah. One task in the following lectures is to study image acquisition process. Okay, our task in the following lectures is to study image acquisition processes, procedures, and their implication in terms of image artifacts. Okay, in the following, we will talk a bit about how we actually get images. And what you will see is that if you have a different modality, you will probably also need an applied or varied version of the preprocessing. So what we do is modality-specific preprocessing. Every modality probably needs its own kind of preprocessing. Even that's maybe even the case that every task, so if you use the same modality for different tasks, you still may need a different preprocessing. And then there's X-ray imaging, magnetic resonance imaging, endoscopy, molecular imaging. Let's have a look at a couple of examples. So this is the image that we got from our experts. They've been spending 2 years in the lab, and they take the first image, and what they get is this. And then they say, okay, 5 people have been working on this project, and this is the best that we can get out of the system. We optimized all parameters, we spent 2 years, and this is the best that you can ever get from this X-ray system. By the way, this is showing some kind of, this is showing the colon, or it's supposed to show the colon. And then you see you have these artifacts here, so there's some structured noise here. You have a lot of noise in general. The contrast is very bad, but this is the best the system can measure. And there's no way to improve it. And then they give it to the imaging process, to the imaging specialist. And the first thing it says is, well, there's consistent noise always here, and it always appears at the same pixels. So this is a kind of a defect pixel problem. Let's remove it. And he uses one of the methods, or some applied methods in this class, and bam, defect pixels are gone. And then he says, well, the contrast is really bad in this image. Let's do something to improve the contrast. And then he types him a couple of MATLAB commands, and there you go, better contrast. This is also something which is, so contrast enhancement is also very well known in image processing. And then he says, well, there's a lot of noise in there. Let's do something against the noise and just filter it out. And you remove the noise. And then you see, now by doing this noise reduction, we have also smeared across the edges. Well, let's do something that enhances the edges, and we add some edge enhancement, and you end with this image. And this image goes to your marketing department, and they will claim this is exactly the data as you measured it from your device. And all of this image processing is something that is part of the measurement process. Yeah? Yes?
I have a question about image preprocessing.
Yes. Yes.
That's the signal we saw in the beginning.
Yes.
And now we are doing processing.
Yes.
So, and the processing, I mean, okay, we have methodologies, we have theory backing it.
Yes.
But it's not the original data, and we can't really. interpolation is the real physical thing behind.
Yes, and this is why you have quality assurance. So what when you develop a medical device, including all the steps that are performed here. So this is part of your measurement. This is part of your imaging system. And then you have an independent body. So first of all, you do image quality assurance yourself. But if you come up with an entirely new device, you have an independent body like the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and they are testing these devices before they are actually employed on patients. And what they do is they do a lot of image quality tests, and they basically apply it on different scenarios and test it for a long time. But the system as it is, including all of the pre-processing, and they want to make sure, and also the vendor, of course, wants to make sure that you can actually use the system for the diagnostic task that you have built it. And what you actually do is you perform studies where you try to fulfill exactly the diagnostic task, and in the end you evaluate the entire system. Because if you had a defect pixel, you're also not measuring the information there. Yeah? So you can't get the information anyway. You can still fill it up by interpolation and you get a nicer appealing image. And now the question is, which image is better suited for the diagnostic task? And this is done, so you don't apply unit tests on every single image processing step because it's dependent on what you put in the first place. But what you do is you perform a test whether you're able to fulfill the diagnostic task that you claim that you can do with it. And these are claims that are made by the vendors, and all of these claims are being approved by FDA. If you construct a new device, if it's only a small change in existing hardware, then they usually have the vendor test everything itself. But there's a huge division at every vendor that is only responsible for quality assurance. So they do all these tests, and this is also one of the main reasons why it takes very long to develop a new medical product. It's not just the implementation and software development, but there's considerable amount of documentation and quality assurance that needs to be applied before you can actually sell a medical product. So you have to have a CE label and so on. And it's always a nice time to talk to the quality guys because they check everything you do very accurately. And if you're applied your pre-processing and what you can show to your customer is this kind of image, he will say, wow, this is a nice image. Yeah? And image quality, if you think of it from a medical vendor point of view, image quality is the selling point. A lot of the decisions, whether you buy the system or not, is the final image quality. And if you have good image pre-processing, then you can compensate for a lot of problems that actually appear in the imaging process in software. Okay? Good. So this is something which is really important, and I don't think there is any medical product out there that does not apply some kind of pre-processing. And if you ask people what they do in their pre-processing, they will say, I don't know. Some other colleague did it. I don't know. I did this part of the change. I know what I did here, but I don't know what the other guys did. So if you would try to reconstruct what's actually done in the pre-processing, you have a hard time. And I'd say it's impossible if you're not part of the company. And even if you're inside the company, it's really difficult to figure out what actually happens in the pre-processing. Because these are well-kept secrets. And this is also a nice example from MR. So you build your 7.5 Tesla machine. You manufactured an entire building around your scanner, and you had some construction costs for the building. You put in the scanner. You had to shield it. You have this tremendous 7.5 Tesla magnet in there that even makes you dizzy when you walk around it too fast, because it will induct current in your brain if you move too fast, and then you measure your image and what you get is this. And I say, now I built this new scanner, I invested a couple of millions. Let's say I invested 15 million in building the scanner, and what I got is this. And then you fire up MATLAB, you do some computations, and then you get this image, and you go to your customer and say, wow, beautiful image. Or let's say you want to differentiate between different kinds of tissues, and you have image noise in here, and you want to differentiate between gray matter and white matter, then you can apply bias field correction, and you can see that you can tremendously improve the separation between gray and white matter. Also something we'll talk about in this term, in this lecture term. Or you have an endoscope. So endoscopes don't cost 50 million, but still, if you have this image or the image on the right, your customer would probably buy the image on the right. Yeah? This is the thing that he would like to see. Here is some CT scan. Here you had photon starvation, which means that along this ray where you see the dark line, all of the photons were absorbed by those two dental fillings. So there's dental fillings in here, and you had no measurement along here. And what you did is you apply some kind of compensation strategy, and you can come up with the image on the right, and you have a very nice compensated image for metal artifact. Okay, take-home messages. Image pre-processing is done before you show it to anybody. So these are the hidden algorithms. It's an art, so people won't talk about the image pre-processing. You don't talk about pre-processing. Rule number two, you don't talk about pre-processing. And it's an art. So there's people working in the large companies that only work on pre-processing and how to tune the parameters such that you get the most appealing image. There's really people who work on filter designs for their entire career in industry. They only optimize their kind of filter in order to get the best image quality out of it. And it's not an option. It's mandatory. Everybody does it. So everybody does something to his images to make them look nicer. And they make sure that you can actually measure the diagnostic task that you intend to do. And there's some further readings. You can look here at reconstruction and restoration, signal processing and communications. And I think that's it. Do you have any questions so far? If that's not the case, Marco Bögl will be here next Monday, okay? And remember this plan. Monday, Marco Bögl, first day off. Monday after that, Professor Honegger. Okay, maybe see you within this lecture term at some occasions. Otherwise, have a good semester. Thank you.